Welcome back to On Becoming, everyone. I'm your host, Ziva Bilal. As we're going further into the season, I'm starting to notice a recurring theme emerge in my guest stories. The journey of discovering one's inner voice and learning to trust it, even and especially when it leads us into uncharted territory. As a career coach, of course, self-trust is the holy grail for aligned transformation. But nurturing this connection with your gut is easier said than done. Those subtle murmurs are often muffled by the shouting of the voices around us. But when a woman deliberately sharpens her intuitive skills, her choices, creations, and words can truly reshape the world. Today, we're joined by one of the most remarkable examples of the empowering connection between the gut and creativity, the Dutch eating designer, Maria Volgenzang. Maria grew up in the Netherlands and entered the prestigious Eindhoven Design Academy in her teens. She almost flunked out. That was until she started to follow her gut and use food as an element of design. After graduating in 2000, Maria created food installations and experimental dinners that led to the launch of the now defunct Proof, a design workshop and experimental restaurant in the Netherlands. In 2008, she published her first book, Eat Love, and in 2022, she published Lick It, an edible exercise book with 32 food challenges designed to radically transform your relationship to food. Alongside giving conferences and hosting edible experiences around the world, she was one of Fast Company's top 100 most creative people in business and was a finalist of the World Technology Awards in the design section. Her work has been exhibited from Tokyo to New York and featured in renowned publications like the New York Times, Wallpaper Magazine, and Icon. In 2014, she became the head of the food non-food department at the Design Eindhoven Academy. And in 2016, she launched the Dutch Institute of Food and Design, a global platform for designers working with food and eating. I couldn't be more delighted to share the journey and wisdom of this grande dame in the field of eating design with you in this wild and entertaining conversation. So, welcome on to the show, Maria.
Thank you.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so excited to be talking with you. We've communicated a bunch of times over email, and I actually realized I interviewed you. I found a copy of Bloom magazine in 2010 and looked at our interview back in the day. So it was funny to recall our previous conversations, but this is the first time that we're speaking face to face, and a lot has happened since then. Maybe you could tell us where you are physically in the world, because you travel quite a bit.
Yeah, right now I'm just home, which is in Dordrecht in the Netherlands, and that's very close to Rotterdam.
And is that where you grew up?
No, I grew up in the east of the Netherlands, but it's such a small country that it's always close by.
You can get around quickly. Yeah. It looks lovely from what I could see with the chickens in the back and winter by your heels. So this podcast is really about kind of taking a look back and exploring the journey that got you where you are today, which is filled with lots of moments of, you know, pushing through doubts or discouragements, convictions. And I think that often we tend to overlook those milestones because we're focused on where we're headed. Is there anything in particular that you are excited about unraveling or exploring a little bit more today?
Well, I think if I look back at what has happened over, I don't know, like the last 25 years, I feel it's like a kind of such a kind of unexpected story. That I think it is, I'm happy to share it because I think it's very relatable, I think, for many people. And it's kind of wonderful to see that things can happen that you don't expect to happen. Yeah. So it feels like a little fairy tale to me.
Oh, okay. So we're going to go on the little, once upon a time fairy tale of Mariah's life. So I wanted to put a little a little pin in how we first started communicating. So back in 2007, I was in a funny transition in my life. I had just gotten back from my honeymoon and I quit my job, literally on the day that I got back to the office because I was miserable. And I was entertaining the idea of becoming a food PR. I wanted to represent people who were doing interesting things in food. And I thought that it would be really great to organize an exhibition. And I reached out to you and I explained the concept. And you were very enthusiastic, very open-minded and exuberant and had this, sure, let's give it a shot. And I always felt so connected to you because I was not someone who was particularly known in the food or design or art field or any of that, but you had this jubilation about you. And I really feel like knowing now more about the work that you do, that those are two traits that are kind of part of who you are, baked into your DNA. How much do you feel like it's important for you to be adventurous and open-minded in having kind of veered off the classic design path to basically create a new genre within that field?
Yeah, I think having had the experience of starting like a new field in design that didn't exist before, and obviously when you start, you have no idea that you're doing that, made me realize, or I think always makes me realize, that like you never know what's happening. You never know what's coming to or what's going to happen. I just decided to do what felt right to me at the time. So looking back as a student, I was training to be a designer. And then I wasn't sure if I wanted to bring all these objects into the world. So I started to work with food because that made me really excited, thinking that I could make something that would go inside your body. I'm still like fascinated by that. But mm-hmm. at the same time, people were telling me like, yeah, but like, food is not for designers. Food is for housewives. That's what they literally said.
Wow.
And for chefs. So that tells me mostly a lot about how they were thinking, not necessarily how I was thinking. And I have noticed that just following my gut feeling there was taking me to really excited places. I could like start restaurants. I traveled the world, and now you can find food and design education all around the world. So to be open to things unexpected is something that has been like at the core of everything I do. Cause when I started, like nothing was telling me really that it was the right step to do. So I really had to rely on my gut feeling there. And, and that has served me so far.
Where do you think you were first exposed to your capacity to rely on your gut feeling?
When I started Design Academy, I was 16 and I just came from middle school and I had no clue what I was doing really. Like I didn't rely on my gut feeling at all. I just thought like I have to do what the teachers tell me because that's what I learned previously. In the beginning of my education, I was a really bad student. They almost kicked me out of school just because I had no clue what I was doing and I wasn't following my gut feeling. I was really trying to answer to the teacher's questions, which in other types of education might work, but in creative education, obviously, you're supposed to find your own path. So I was really struggling with that until actually that moment that they did tell me, like, maybe you should go to a different school. And then I said, well, maybe can I just have one more try? And then I told myself, maybe I should just do what I want to do, what I think is interesting or what gives me joy. And then I started working like that and that changed everything around.
Mm.
And I think it's such a wonderful
thing.
So this
thing. Is when you were at 16 at Eindhoven?
Yeah, well, I think this was by before. Then I was about 18 probably, because the first years were like, yeah, I was very young and I was going out every night to drink and meet people. I think now you can also see in my work, there's a huge part of psychology and social interaction.
Mm.
And somehow I think these drunken nights of talking with people actually informed that a little bit. I was interested in design, but I was mostly interested in people. And so getting into making the shape of a chair didn't interest me that much as like having talks with people and eating.
Well, I love already that we're using the term gut feeling as opposed to intuition or instinct, since you specialize in tickling the gut, stimulating the gut in the work that you do. What was it like eating for you growing up?
I don't know how much you know about Dutch food, but it's not known for being very experimental or very exciting or very flavorful. Mm-hmm. So I think my curiosity really comes from the lack of all of that. So a kind of open space of nothingness. So I think as a child, I was really missing a kind of culinary wealth. It was very simple, very plain. But I was also missing a kind of spiritual wealth or a ritual of food or eating. So I think there's this kind of mental emptiness that came that I experienced in my childhood that was also very boring and bland. And so I didn't go to a lot of exhibitions or see a lot of designers. When I started design school, I was really is it green or blue? I don't know. Unexperienced.
Meaning like kind of naive?
Naive, yeah. Sometimes people say like, when you give a child a lot of stimulus, they grow. And I think that can happen. But sometimes I also think that the lack of that makes them very curious to explore later on. And that was what happened for me.
So it was kind of this wasteland of blandness and not stimulation. And that triggered something in you because you wanted to fill it with more interesting flavors or colors or textures? Is it that you were drawn to something that wasn't in your environment and you imagined that it existed?
And also I was looking for meaningful things. So everything was very meaningless to me. But the thing is that I wasn't imagining that with the food part because I just didn't know it existed. So I only knew the food that my parents made for me. And then I started studying and then go and live in another city in a house with other students. And then they start to cook. And then suddenly I realized that there was a whole world of food. And now it sounds so silly to say that because now you have internet, but there was no internet. So the world was just a lot smaller. And also with food. So I always loved doing stuff with food. But I didn't, as a child, I didn't really get the chance to experiment a lot. But I would love to make, for example, little canapés when I was like 12 or so, if people would come over to the house and I made them all slightly different so I could observe like who would pick which one. So those kind of little social experiments I was interested in, but I didn't even know there was something called sushi, for example. I got very excited when I was a student and I suddenly realized that there was much more. And I started to go to the library and I borrowed those old Japanese books. Actually, I think Japanese food, that's where it started because it was so completely different than all the food that I knew.
I imagine if you are in an environment where you're going to school, there's kind of an expectation about the way that you would express yourself or the materials you would use. Here you decide that you're going to venture into food design. Where were you getting the response that was helping you make that decision? Were there other people, maybe not technically food designers, but other examples that were calling you and they were like, oh, this, there's something here for me to explore? What were those examples?
I'm not sure necessarily examples, but I do think that like at that point in time, which was the end of the 90s at the Design Academy in Eindhoven, there was this whole notion of conceptual design really emerging from Droog design. This idea that as a designer, you didn't necessarily have to make an object. You can also make a service. You could also make an experience or a choreography or anything that's not necessarily tangible. And for me, that really was an idea that fueled me incredibly, because I wasn't that good also at making stuff. I wasn't like my peers. They made beautiful things, and I was kind of jealous because I couldn't do that, like physically so well. But I also like it didn't like excite me that much. And this idea that it could also be a service or even like a massage therapy, right? That made me very excited, because that was such a kind of new idea at the time. So I think that really informed my decision to work with food. And also there were many people who didn't understand it. But for example, my mentors, Lee Edelkort and Lisbeth van het Innethout, they were really understanding what I was doing with food. When I made my first project, it was a white funeral dinner. And they took that to Milan and they exhibited that. And it wasn't my graduation project. It was just a project in, I think, my third year or so. So there were a lot of people who didn't understand or appreciate it, but they were there and they took it with them. And they also showed me that it was something, because I was very insecure about everything that I did.
That's wonderful that you had them. I think what you said, it's so profound, because if you're observing your peers who are maybe very skilled technically at creating something, and you're there and you're like, well, that's not something that I'm capable of doing. There must be something that I'm lacking. But instead, you lean into the space that you're curious about, that you're actually like, wait, there's more for me to find out. And this brings me joy. What if you stop worrying about the technical or the craftsmanship, the skills that you felt like you didn't have, and really apply yourself to the area that does spark this joy in you? And to have people on your side that are encouraging along the way is so precious, because
absolutely,
you can definitely be eaten by the demons of like, well, I'm lacking these other things.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially at that age, you're so insecure. And when you do something that, because that's the whole thing. Like there was no example. There were no other people doing that and who were established in their ways. So that it's a very kind of like unknown open field you step into. So you do need someone. And that's maybe also why I do respond to email requests of people that might not like have made their name yet, because everything's open and new. So I think it's worth to respond to that. Like last week I responded to a girl who was in her first year of a design school in Belgium, and she was just asking, maybe you have some ideas, I don't know what to do. And I thought, well, you know, I might not like give you a huge list of things, but I could send some words to you.
For someone who is thinking about embarking on in a direction where it's so open and it's so fresh, it's so new, one of the fears that frequently catches people in their stride is, well, what are you going to do with this? How are you going to make a living? Is this a viable career? I'm sure you've heard those messages. How did you push through those? And how do you continue to feel confident that things are going in the direction you want, or that you can have a viable career doing what you do?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think it became so much more easy now. So when I started, that was like 23 years ago, like it just didn't exist. So even making conceptual dinners was something that was new in people's minds. And now, like more than two decades later, you can see that like the world understands conceptual dinners. That's not such a big deal. You can do that. That's all. That's like the low hanging fruit. People want to pay for it. People are really searching for special experiences, that meaningful experiences, sensorial experiences, getting away from your screen, getting away from only looking at things. So that is already kind of easy to do. But then all the other things I can see that within industry, and I speak at a lot of conferences of food innovation forums, and everywhere people are looking for creative ideas. So I think this kind of superpower of being able to use imagination with food is what like the world is really, really looking for. And so big issues like climate change, like pollination decline, like obesity, like pollution, all these things, people start to see that. They see that it's related to food. When I started, I had to explain to people why it would be important to use organic products in my restaurant, for example. There were people who say, yeah, you're studying a restaurant. Yeah, you should do that if you want. But why organic food? You don't taste the difference, right? I really had to kind of advocate for that. And now you see that people start to understand that it has a bigger impact, that food has such a huge impact on yourself, on your health, on your relationship with others. So food as a topic has increased so much in its importance to people. When you're entering the world of food, you're entering the biggest economy in the world. There is money in food. But there's also a lack of innovative ideas because many people who work in the world of food are specialists. So those people know everything, how to make the most milk from a cow, for example, or they know everything, how to crossbreed varieties of seeds to make like perfect resistant crops, or they know how to logistically manufacture, I don't know, streams of food to go from one place on the earth to the other. So there's a lot of specialists. There's a lot of technical knowledge within food. But I think the one of the things that designers can do, they can be a bridge between those kind of players, because being a specialist also means that you are focusing only on what you do, because that's what you need to do as a specialist. But as a designer, you can freely move between these different actors and connect them together in unexpected ways. So your currency is not the knowledge. You don't need to know everything about food, but to be able to communicate and to be able to bring this kind of different view on things, to be able to twist an idea around and to show people, for example, well, the way we deal with this is actually very irrational. And can we make this different, for example, or can we normalize something that we're not used to? I see that there's endless work within food, especially if you have a creative mind.
That's so cool. Well, yeah, it really feels like it's plugging creativity and innovation and the ability to problem solve into an industry that is in a way very classic and very, you know, very industrialized. And merging this field, as you say, that has like, you know, it's the number one industry in the world, with a kind of side door approach, using that creative vitality to problem solve aspects of the food industry that touch so much of humanity and our world and the ecosystem.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's always problem solving. I would rather speak of bringing alternatives. Because I think problem solving is also what is a problem. People have been trying to problem solve previous problems, and that's how we got into this mess. So I would rather speak of bringing alternatives. The more alternatives we have, the more we can steer away from our current mechanisms and find new experiences that, for example, bring more meaning into your life through food. You wouldn't necessarily say that that is problem solving if I bring more meaning into your life through food, but because you might say, well, I don't really have a problem with having meaning. But if I do add meaning to your life through food, it would be very valuable to you.
I love that. Yeah, it's true. Problem solving, it makes things very serious and reductive, but alternatives opens the scope.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned at some point that you feel like humans have creative poverty, and that maybe one way that you could build up creativity is returning the focus to the sensations in the body. And you mentioned that you practice meditation. Where's the relationship there between sensations in the body and creative expansion and vitality?
Yeah. You know, I think the reason why I work with food is not because I'm necessarily such a foodie, even though I do like food, but it's actually not about the food. the reason why I work with food is because it's about humans, because the food is my entry to the human being. Like, it's a great excuse.
You found yes, a clever trick.
That's my trick. And I think the human being, that's really what fascinates me the most, because when we eat, our food experience is determined by how we think, and not necessarily our food experience, like our whole experience of what we call life is determined by how we think. So if we think that everybody is an asshole, then we will come across assholes all the time. And if we say, or if we really think like people are lovely, then we always meet lovely people. And and it's this kind of confirmation bias that we have. I'm so fascinated by our psychology, by how we think and how we act. And our imagination, our capacity for imagination, is what will determine whether we have a joyful or meaningful life or not. Because if we are able to have a flexible mind, then we will probably also have a more joyful life. And what I see right now, that a lot of people are restricted in their mind, in their ways of thinking, also because of their upbringing, because of how society functions. Like, there can be many reasons. But you also have the freedom to let go of that and to experience a more rich and joyful life in that sense. One of the ways to do that can be through your senses, because we also really ignore our bodies. Sometimes at the end of the day, I think, well, I have just been sitting behind the screen. It's as if my whole body is deteriorated into a brain with eyes and maybe two sticks to walk on to go and get some coffee. Kids, they don't have that. Like, they fully sensorially experience the world with their bodies, and they can have a lot of joy from that. And of course, when you grow up, it's understandable that maybe you're not acting as a kid anymore, but it doesn't mean that you have to ignore this kind of free superpower that you got, which is your whole body that you can explore the world with, plus your imagination. Because I think the borders of your mind, that's where things become interesting. So if you have this kind of comfort zone that you always stay inside of, and you never cross that border, you never become curious of what is outside of that comfort zone, then you do not expand your experience. And expanding your experience, I think as a human species, this is where we find the meaning of our lives. Those are the things that give us joy. I think physical experiences can help, also our sensorial experiences can help you expand yourself a little bit more. A lot of the projects I do are slightly scary. I think you can tell, right? Like, I mm-hmm. invite people to do something that's kind of strange in many
risky,
cases.
Risky. Yeah.
The interesting thing is that it's not really risky, because what can really go wrong, right? If you do not eat with your hands, but you graze off an upside down glass, for example, there's nothing really risky going on. But in our minds, we say, wow, maybe people think we're awkward because now we're like not using our hands to eat. We're eating like a cow. But what is really scary about that, right? So it's always assessing this. But I have found that if you do that in the right way, where people do feel comfortable, they have an experience that they have never had in their lives. I mean, not that experience before. And always afterwards, people feel very excited and very fueled up, because aren't we also looking for new experiences in our life? Aren't we looking also to be challenged and to like find like this new part of ourselves that we didn't know we had because we didn't dare to go out of that comfort zone? So yeah, that is
absolutely. Well, there's so many layers here. There are a couple of things that I think are really interesting. It's this idea that the risk factor is in the imagined judgment that we would receive from others mm-hmm. about doing something that is not what you're supposed to do, or it's maybe going to be messy, or you're going to be awkward, you're not going to do it right. So much of what we do that's in our comfort zone are rituals that are accepted by the norm, mm-hmm. that this is the protocol. You're falling into place. But you're inviting people to like eat with their faces. You're inviting them to eat food that looks like inedible food. You're pushing people to explore the limits of their fear of being judged. Because I think in a way, you're also doing it in a social environment where it's normalized. Mm-hmm. And that's such a huge gift that you give people, is to create a safe space for them to realize that they can have a new experience. And doing it with other people means that they're not going to be seen as different or other or somehow flawed because they don't do it correctly, because no one's doing it correctly. Everyone's doing it for the first time.
Yeah, many times I do it first. So I also show.
You show them. You pave the way.
Yeah. Not always, but yeah, I know it can be helpful that if I look silly, then, well, I guess everybody thinks, well, apparently she knows, so let's just do it too. So that can help as well. Yeah.
Mm. If you look at the overall intent of your work, what are you looking for as a food designer? What is your number one intention about what you hope to achieve for yourself and what you hope other people will experience? How do you know that you've checked the box for yourself and for others?
Yeah, for others, I think at the base of all my work, there is for me an intention of helping people to think differently. That's really what's below everything I do, because I think it is a wealth that you can acquire that doesn't cost any money to think beyond your regular thoughts. And that I think that is truly magic. I've spent also in my new book, I spend a lot of chapters on helping people to start to see, or to helping people to start to train themselves to see differently or to experience differently and to be open to that. And it gives you a wealth of resilience as well, because if you can have different thoughts about things, you are so much more resilient to the whole of life. Like, it really goes beyond mm-hmm. food or culinary experience. And for myself, what I always want to do is I want to do things that scare me a little bit. So I want to practice what I preach. So I want to take on projects that are new for me that I haven't done before. So also the writing my book was something like that. Like I wanted to make something that's more accessible to a larger audience, because the previous work, the installations, the museum exhibitions, the dinners, all these things, they, in a way, it's also elitist. Like, you can only invite a certain number of people. So making the book, writing it, like, I'm not a writer, so that was a very new experience. It's also for me to go outside of my comfort zone and to do something that is forcing me to step into a new thing. I became a hypnotherapist also because of that. I'm now working on a kind of theater experience where I'm using the tools that I learned as a hypnotherapist to guide people through a kind of theater story where they are not using their eyes, but they're using all their other senses. But it is a visual experience, because their own mind is starting to produce the visuals for this story. And they're the main character in the story. So they become also the actor in the play. So that is also something I've never done before. So I think, you know, also the restaurants that I've had, it's just like stepping into things that, like, getting myself into trouble because I don't really know how to do it, but I think, you know, if I'm going to look back at my life and I'm going to know that I have expanded and that I have like made and also fell on my face and learned from it. So I'm not going to repeat everything the whole time. I'm expanding.
Mm. So you want people to be able to expand their experience of life by being confronted with certain comforts and realizing that they can grow through them. And at the same time, in the work that you do, your intention is to constantly challenge yourself to get uncomfortable mm-hmm. and to see what happens on the other side.
Yeah. And it's not always uncomfortable, by the way. Like it's challenging.
It's not always uncomfortable.
You can be also be incredibly fun. Like it's, and also for like, now it sounds as if I'm always giving people like really scary things to eat and to do. That's not the case. Like it can also be very joyful.
No, there's small challenges.
Just different. Yeah. just had to say that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure there are those degrees of discomfort and risk, mm-hmm. and you are always kind of riding that line of the balance of something that you haven't done or is stretching, but you feel like you can get there, and you're kind of developing the neurons and the whatever kind of tools you need in order to get through it. It sounds like very much like the flow state. This is one of the things that I've learned about the flow state is when we're challenged with something that forces us to go outside of stretch our comfort zone. But at the same time, we know that we have the resources that are going to allow us to get there. When things dip into the routine and familiar, we get bored and we're not growing anymore. And when things are too difficult, we abandon. Mm-hmm. the project. So it's really kind of like finding that perfect combination of I'm stretching and I know I can get there, but I'm going to have to, I don't know exactly what I'm going to use, mm-hmm. but I know that I have inside of me the resources in order to meet the challenge. Where did that intention, that quest, or even that reality first materialize for you? Because that seems to be something that's maybe baked into an environmental or societal form of encouragement. I know that in France, that is not a very common approach as an intention for life to experience discomfort and see that you can match it. Is it something that you feel was an energy or a message that you were exposed to growing up?
No, not at all. When I was growing up, I think it was also very much informed by my studies at Design Academy, where you're always challenged to go beyond what you think you know, to go beyond the first idea, to go beyond the first response, to go deeper, to go really challenge to think in a different way. I think that really shaped my mind in a different way, and because I decided to go for food to work with, and because it didn't exist yet, I think I've had to just to survive. I've just had to like deal with that a lot to, because if there's no other, like if you're an architect and people say, oh, well, what do you do? And then you can say, well, yeah, I'm an architect and, my work looks a little bit like this other person or this. Then there's a kind of framework or context and people understand more or less what you do. But for me, like there was no framework or context. So I've always had to explain what I do and I've always had to do to show, what it could be. So I think I was pushed from the beginning of my career to do that. And I've learned to embrace that. I think in 2019, I started doing very actively, I started doing meditation. I started understanding more about the workings of the brain. And so now I really consciously use meditation. I really consciously use journaling and, really reshaping the brain, and using that also to teach my, food design students that they can use that as well, because it just gives you an incredible advantage also to be able to work in flow, for example, and to understand how can you listen to your gut feeling? How can you actively use that in your whole life, not just in your professional life, but also in your private life?
Right. To develop that sense, that sense relationship.
Mm-hmm.
With that in mind, if you weren't working with food, if you weren't a food designer, eating designer, which do you prefer, eating designer, food designer? Do you have?
Yeah, well, I do not design food literally. So in that sense, yeah. I'm not necessarily a food designer because food is already designed by other people and by my nature. So in that sense, I'm an eating designer because I work from the verb of eating. Sometimes I say edible philosophy. I don't really mind what you call it.
Okay. Well, if you weren't an eating philosopher, eating designer, What other way would you be satisfying your intention?
I think then in that way, maybe I would be a ritual designer, designing rituals for people.
Like what?
My very first project was a funeral dinner, and I still feel very related to that project. I sometimes redesign the funeral dinner. Right now it's on show in an exhibition in Amsterdam, and I was collecting stories. I was asking people, if you would die and you would be dead, and then you would want to establish yourself or materialize yourself to let your friends know that you're there, how would you do that? And as an example, my aunt, she was dying, and she was saying before she died, if you see a spider, you know it's me. So now my mom, when she sees a spider, she takes it, she puts it outside, and she says, bye, sister, to the spider. And it's really nice, because every now and then you just remind yourself of that person in that way. And so I started asking this question, and I wrote it on the ceramics that I was making for this funeral dinner, because it's made handmade ceramics and with written text on it now. So I always expand on this idea. And then it's beautiful, because then you see that people start to talk about that. And you also see that some people are very uncomfortable. My dad had a really hard time. He didn't really want to answer it seriously. And some people do. And they start to really think about their own death and what they would want for their death. And my oldest daughter says that she will come back as an amazing bargain. So every time you see an amazing bargain, you know, oh that's her. I hope I will never experience that though.
It's like she's coming back as Black Friday.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly. Yeah. One person said that she was coming back as a stray dog who would pass your legs and then touch them gently. And I thought it was such a beautiful thing. So yeah. I love those kind of things. I really love to find connections between people on a very personal level.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the hardest part about having lots of ideas? How do you know which ideas are the ones to sink your teeth into?
I used to find that harder than I do now, maybe because I've had a lot of experience and I was more impatient in the past. When I started, I just wanted to prove myself and I wanted to do all my ideas. And now I know that I have this whole body of work, and you just build on this body of work and you make new projects. And it's this thing that grows like plants grow. You can't force them to grow. Like it grows, and it grows steadily, and sometimes it grows hard and then it doesn't grow that fast. So I have a lot of ideas. I put them in my books. I always write them down. How to know what to do? I do really feel it's gut feeling. And what I also do is I go in meditation and I ask my future self, because your future self, she knows what to do. She knows what you did, you know, from the future perspective. You can say, hey, what did I do there? And your future self will know. So I go in meditation. I use a form of meditation called prime light meditation. It's from my mentor, Jesse Elder. He taught me also to teach it to others. So I used to teach this type of meditation. And it's very cool, because I know it sounds silly to go in meditation, ask your future self, but your future self is badass. Like your future self knows exactly what to do, like the best version of your future self, because obviously you have multiple versions, but you ask your best self, best version.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get answers that always make sense. I don't know. It's amazing. Like you always get the right answer. And if you follow through, then you will find that it is indeed the right thing for you to do.
All right. I am putting that. Links are happening,
magic,
in the show notes,
right?
Too.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
The thing is that, look, I know it sounds like I'm crazy when I say this, but I'm sure that you've had an experience that has given you the same experience. Like maybe you walked sometimes in a park many times it happens by yourself. Some people have it when they run. I sometimes have it when I have a shower. You sometimes just know something, something which is right. And that's what happens then.
Well, a lot of it is being able to practice that, cultivate a connection with your intuition, your future self, your best version, that is, that over time becomes stronger and stronger and more direct, or more, you know what's happening, you can trust it. I think that it's part of a practice that needs to be really nurtured. I find it, especially with the women who I'm coaching, who are going through, you know, big questions about their future selves, who they want to be, and maybe they haven't been encouraged to think in a outside of the box way about the versions of themselves that could really bring joy and satisfaction to them. A lot of it is about cultivating a practice that allows them to connect with this source of information, because it's not a rational source, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more ephemeral. It's a lot more mysterious and intangible. So what you're saying really speaks to me, and I think it's going to be really helpful for people.
And it can also be really banal, right? Like, I sometimes have a lot of fun with my future self, and she's just laughing at me. She says, "Well, don't be so silly. Just like, don't
just eat the chocolate. Yeah. Just like, just."
And then we're just laughing.
Grab a burger.
Like, it can be so simple. Yeah. So it's not always that spiritual in the way that, like, you think, wow, it's angels and think. It can also just be like very basic, like simple life joy.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. So we've explored your, you know, Mariah's past self, your, you know, not so distant past, where you are now. Also, you have a connection with your future self. Based on everything we've discussed so far, what little tidbits are you walking away from this conversation with that maybe reveal something about the person that you're becoming more of?
Well, maybe it's interesting to know that, like, even though in my work life, I've always had a really good connection with my gut feeling, maybe because I had to, also because I chose to work with food. But it also always felt like this refugee where, like, in my work, I can be very free. But in my private life, I had a really hard time, felt really depressed, really struggling with self-love. And I really, I want to say that because I think it's very important to mention that, because I know that a lot of people feel that too. Like, it's, like, the world, you might feel that the world wants a lot from you, and you might feel very insecure. And sometimes you feel that the life is happening to you, and you're just fighting off whatever happens to you, right? And I've had that experience for many years. I've been in a really abusive marriage. When I started meditating, and when I started to really listen to my gut feeling, and also being helped by my mentor, that really started to release. And I really started to let go of that. And I started to honestly love myself and honestly enjoy my private life and to free myself. And what I have found is that a lot of the things that keep you down, that keep you small, that make you feel that you're worthless, are constructs in your mind that you are allowed to shed. You are allowed to let go of this feeling. You are allowed to be here. You are allowed to take space. You are allowed to enjoy life and to love yourself. And I think generally when we talk about work things, we don't talk about this. But I think, how can you be a successful professional if below that you do not love yourself or allow yourself to really live as a human being? And I think it's very important to align those two things, to really give yourself time to work on yourself, to find a mentor, to find someone who can help you if you find it hard to do it by yourself. Because eventually, you'll be dead sometime in the future. It might be long, it might be short. But when you look back at your life and you've maybe have had a successful career, but below that you haven't enjoyed yourself as a human being, or loved yourself. I think that's just such a shame and very unnecessary. So I just want to mention that because sometimes we're so focused on the executive functions of what we do. But how can you think that you're able to do all of that if below that, you know, you hate yourself or you're saying bad things to yourself? Everybody has their own responsibility for themselves. Like, no one's going to fix it for you. You have to do that yourself.
Well, thank you so much for adding that information. And I think it's so relevant to look under the hood and see who is the person who is maybe having the successful life. And is that person allowing themselves to feel the joy and feel the plenitude that is within her reach? And what are the tools in order to make that happen? And that is really the holistic experience, right? It's not just about our output, our productivity, and our contribution, but how are we talking to ourselves, and are we gentle and loving? So thank you so much for sharing your journey with us, Mariah, and taking the time to speak. It's been an absolute pleasure and very eye-opening. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And till we meet again.
Yeah. Nice to see you finally.
Yeah, I know. It's been great. I am so appreciative of having your time and your attention and would love to hear anything you have to say, any feedback, any questions, any requests. You can leave me a voice message if you go to speakpipe.com/onbecoming. That's speakpipe, speakpipe.com/onbecoming. I promise to get back to you. If this podcast has touched you, inspired you, transformed you in any way, it would mean the world to me if you would leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast listening platform.